everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for 1 hour. So our first movie, and it's a good one, is Metropolitan. Our bad movie is Of Unknown Origin. And Metropolitan we're going to talk about first. You'd seen this one before. It was your recommendation, and it's really ahead of its time in a lot of ways. It taps into, I mean, ostensibly it's about preppies of a very specific region and social order. They're Upper East Side Manhattanites, and their families are in the Hamptons and, you know, the rich areas of New York and New York State. But it, in terms of its not just ornateness, but the problems of its protagonists and the kind of I mean, they're navel gazers, and this movie is kind of satirical about it, but a little loving too, which is odd. And I don't know, without trying to describe it, it certainly influenced films of Noah Baumbach, like The Squid and the Whale. And certainly Wes Anderson, although Wes Anderson is a little more Tim Burton than Whit Stillman, the writer and director of the film. But it reminds you of that, because maybe it's just the manneredness of the characters and the extreme articulation that they have. And, I mean, the characters of Metropolitan are more talky than some of the films that they've influenced, but it's their intellect, they all sort of share the same kind of intellect, and that's the same intellect and sense of humor that a lot of, you know, maybe we don't have the genre name for it yet, but, you know, for movies that appeal to hip young people, for lack of a better description. And it was really funny, and, you know, what surprised me the most was I was expecting, you know, the kind of cursory plot description I'd read said that it's about an outsider making his way into this group of elite preppies. They're on they're supposed to be on winter break from their first year in various prep schools. What surprised me was that it wasn't about that interloper wasn't either. He wasn't really an outsider to them. In fact, he seemed completely suited to them, and by the end of the film, he's one of them. And it's not done in any kind of dark way, or suggesting that he's been corrupted, because Whit Stillman, as it turns out, has a lot of sympathy and understanding for these people, and, you know, for all the weirdness that their wealth and upbringing gives them, he still sees them as people. And, you know, in disclosure, of course, biographically, Whit Stillman's mother apparently was a debutante, so he, you know, he knew the world, and he wasn't making this film as an attack on it, or a vicious satire. I mean, you can certainly say it's a satire, but it's not a scolding satire, which is maybe more what I was expecting. That was a big surprise to me.
Yeah, I didn't really know what to expect, because I saw his movies in reverse order. So I saw Last Days of Disco.
And he's only made three, and they were spaced about 4 years apart.
And, yeah, and about the time Last Days of Disco came out, people took the time to make websites. This is back in the, you know, late 90s websites, when everybody had a website dedicated to something except themselves. And, you know, there was all sorts of, I think you can still find it. I think after I saw this, I found it. And it was Whit Stillman talking about his next movie or something. And he hasn't done anything. He wrote a book that was a sort of half sequel, half adaptation, I think, of Last Days of Disco. And it came out from some boutique press in New York.
And the movie was a huge bomb, which is probably more reason than anything why he hasn't made a movie in about 10 years now.
Well, I mean, it was a bomb, but what did they expect? I don't think he ever made any money. Metropolitan, I remember.
Got got him nominated for an Oscar for original screenplay.
And it was very, it wasn't what I was expecting when I saw it, because it seemed very, the box cover, I guess. Now it has a very illustrated Criterion.
Yeah, it's out from Criterion now, so it has a fan. But I've never seen the original video box.
It was just kind of them sitting around talking, and it seemed a lot like one of those. There's some other movie from that period with Will Wheaton about these guys who in boarding school and somebody, not School Ties, but some other one. Where, I mean, it just seemed like a torpid drama type thing. Like a Merchant Ivory. It seemed like an American Merchant Ivory to me from the box. And this is me as a 12-year-old, so I had no interest in it. And what I always think of when I watch the movie is, I don't know if it's Kevin Smith. I want to say it is, but I could be totally wrong. He once made a joke about how nobody understood the New Yorker. Nobody thought New Yorker cartoons were actually funny. And I always kind of see Metropolitan as a movie for people who think New Yorker cartoons are funny. Because the humor is, I mean, the editing is really crisp. That's the funny thing is, the first interchange with Edward Clemens character, Tom, and this group, it's really quickly edited for emphasis. So, I mean, it's very rapid fire editing, so you get the humor out of everything.
Yeah, no, and you got to have great editing with a dialogue movie. Although some of those scene transitions were very odd. This movie uses a lot of fade to blacks, which you don't see very often. It's almost like you're watching it, going to commercial and then coming back without any commercials in between. In a lot of scenes.
I mean, I think it was produced by the public PBS. Oh no, never mind. For some reason, I thought it was produced by that American Playhouse, but it wasn't, so ignore me.
I think I read on Wikipedia or IMDb that Whit Stillman sold his apartment. I mean, but you know, I read that, but it's like whatever. His mom is a debutante, I assume. Right. There's some money somewhere.
Well, and that's the other thing is, of this period, you know, the cheap independent movie, this is a lot more finished than that. This is...
Right, yeah. No, this was made by, you know, someone with money, although it's an independent production made by someone with money to spend.
And what's strange is that I don't think he has any experience other than this before he made this. Looks like he was an actor in Spanish movies, because Barcelona is autobiographical. And then this was his first direction. And but it's as polished as something like, I'd say, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which had reasonably big Hollywood stars, except it's very different in the sort of polish, because it is the kind of thing you see from... Rushmore got a lot of its editing cues, for example, from this, before, you know, Wes Anderson really got big into the special effects thing.
Yeah, I mean, and what Wes, yeah, it's, wow, it's true. Rushmore really was his least special effects laden thing.
Bottles.
He just made a cartoon movie.
Right, yeah, I haven't even seen the preview for that. But yeah, so.
That looks hideous. No, yeah, and what Wes Anderson kind of, in terms of, like, framing and composition and editing, he's willing, as Whit Stillman does a lot in Metropolitan, to just do a tight close-up of an actor delivering really long, kind of monologous dialogue, although Wes Anderson's dialogue isn't as long, and just kind of, you know, and it's very erudite, and they're being completely straight-faced about it, and there's supposed to be something, you know, a little absurd in how seriously they take themselves, a lot like, you know, Jason Schwartzman's character in Rushmore is a lot like the characters in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, these are very...
Oh, and it takes place at a prep school, of course. Rushmore.
Yeah. I mean, the conversations these guys have is sort of I'm trying to think of how to say it. They seem more they seem to be yuppies during their college period when they have they're still philosophical before they become burnout mid-level managers. And one of the interesting things about it is that slowly you find out all sorts of things about the movie because it drops into it without really a first act. You see Edward Clement's character standing on the street by a cab, and he's invited into this cab by these society types. And yeah, he sort of assumes that this is this great standard, and it's called the Sally Fowler after party something.
Yeah. It's about the social group that he gets invited to by chance does nothing but dinner parties apparently during their winter break. That's all they're into, dinner parties with debutantes who have to have escorts, men matched up to them. And it's very old world and very aristocratic.
And what's interesting about it is that Clement's character doesn't have money. And we don't know that right away, even though it's sort of hinted at because of his coat.
And it's sort of strange because he really shares the same personality as the rest of them. It's just that he doesn't have as much money. He's middle class, not upper class.
And there's some suggestion that that's as a result of his parents' divorce, that he sort of was cut loose. So he got to go to the good schools, but, you know, and he knows these people, but he doesn't have the sort of social thing going on. But what's strange is that they acknowledge this. Chris Eichmann's character, and I mean, Chris Eichmann kind of runs off with the movie in some ways. Except what's weird about it is that for a certain period, everybody runs away with the movie except Edward Clements, which I guess would make him sort of the protagonist, even though he turns out to be sort of an aloof twit. So he's not really the protagonist either. I mean, the girl, the movie opens with this girl, Caroline Farina, who apparently her little brother, who's never seen, makes fun of her bust size. And that's off screen, and they never discuss it, except the mother says, how would he know? And then at the end of the movie, this comes back, that they talk about this, and she's in love with Clements from meeting him. And then you find out that she's in love with him because when she was at school, his girlfriend gave her all of his letters of his, you know, sort of, and this is the kind of funny thing is, it's these people at boarding school who are writing these long intellectual treaties on, you know, French philosophers of the 1960s. And this is the kind of thing that you can't really do in a Kevin Smith movie. It's like if you replace Metropolitan with there's not enough drama because Kevin Smith movies all have drama. They're not really about people sitting around talking. There's always a huge whatever. So you get through the whole movie, and the closest thing you get to a romantic conclusion between these two people, even though Clements sort of realizes that she's the girl he wants to be with, even there's no anticipation of where this movie's going to go. Like, you don't have any, you know, you don't really see anything past the conclusion, which is... it's kind of like, I think I described this when we talked about watching it, as sort of a yuppie Woody Allen, but one of his ones without Woody Allen type thing. Mm-hmm. The big thing is she makes a comment to him.
If you can think of the couples and husbands and wives and crimes and misdemeanors as early 20-somethings, it's kind of like that.
But then you get to the end, and their big romantic resolution is she asks him if he thinks that... her boobs are too small. And there's your big romantic payoff. And she smiles at him a little bit earlier when she realizes this. And that's the big romantic payoff. And it's hilarious that it's I wouldn't even call it subtle or disinterested. It's just so quiet. And that I laugh out loud at this movie and a lot during the exchanges, because Taylor Nichols and Chris Eichmann are both... really funny, and later on you discover that Chris Eichmann actually does have like some depth to his character that you didn't expect.
Yeah, Chris Hagman seems like he's going to be the villain because he's taking in Edward Clements, and it's a bit too much like, you know, uh-oh, what's he, is he setting him up for some carry situation or something? I don't know. But then it turns out, like, no, he's actually, he actually wants to take him under his wing and, you know, give him a social life with him because he thinks he has integrity. And, yeah, it's great. And like you said, he kind of steals the movie, and he's so great that they have to write him out of the movie. You know, about three quarters of the way, they have him get on a train and never come back. And I kind of want to talk about the 30s thing, because there's no, like, when he's getting on a subway car, but Stillman shoots it like he's getting on a train in an old movie, you know, that's going chug, 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 woo, woo, and, you know, going off into some foreign land or something. These dinner parties that the social groups have, I mean, is this real? Is this what real yuppies, or not yuppies, real preppies in that social strata do? They dress in black tie and bow tie and, you know, put on old records and dance the cha-cha-cha and play bridge. And, I mean, they're kind of deliberately doing this kitsch thing of acting like, you know, they're in a Thin Man movie or something. And it's never commented on, which is weird.
Well, Stillman was born in 52. And so he would have been 18
wow.
in 70, 70 20 and 72.
And I didn't so, know he was that old. Yeah.
So the tag on this is not so long ago. And so I've always been curious about that, not having any knowledge of the sort of yuppie scene. Because, I mean, that's the other thing is, I guess if you looked and figured out when yuppies started being used as a term, you would clue it in because they have a real problem with that. They don't think that yuppies a good term.
Yeah, I mean, and Metropolitan never uses the word. It's... Or, you know,
do they not? Sort of, I thought they had the argument about it. They don't use the word yuppie when they're talking about the UHB.
I guess, yeah, maybe once or twice. It's just not the focus so much as the preppy thing. And there's this one character. Is it Taylor Nichols?
Yeah.
He's all he does is go on and on, you know, like a stoned sociology student about, like you said, French philosophers and Marxism and socialism and isms, basically, the way college students can go on about isms. And there's something kind of relatable and funny about that. You don't have to be a preppy in the Upper East Side to know that type of person.
I'm not sure that... I mean, obviously Stillman's from that background, but I wonder... Would you find it funny if you were of that background? I mean, even though that background has now become, what, Paris Hilton or something like that, but...
Stillman, I mean, has some awareness of the humor in so far as he has Edward Clements give that great line about how he doesn't read books, he reads literary criticism, and that's better than actually reading the books, because then you you find out what the book is about and you get the author's opinion, the critic's opinion. So, I mean, he's clearly, you know, making a joke about it there.
I mean, yeah, it's the whole thing of these sort of socially privileged college students sitting around griping about the travails of the lower class while sipping champagne and things like that. And Last Days of Disco actually features a bunch of characters from this. Or at
no
least
way.
Three of them. Audrey's back as an editor. She's a famous editor. Sally Fowler's in it for a second. Fred's in it sleeping for a second. And what's really interesting is I think Taylor Nichols is in Last Days of Disco playing two characters, playing his character from this, but also his character from Barcelona. Yeah, and Rick Von Sloniker's in it.
Kevin Smith, eat your heart out with your Kevin Smith universe there.
So, yeah, it's Taylor Nichols is in it playing his character from both of the other movies. And so I guess that always got me thinking that it was somehow set in the early 70s. And the TV,
well,
that makes
the black tie thing make a hell of a lot more sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's got that going thing.
I'm just trying, yeah, but this, I mean, you know, there's shots that were obviously modern shots, and there's some street scenes that are obviously 1990 New York. I'm trying to think of any, like, culture outside of the records and stuff that they listen to that would indicate
they don't mention a thing. It's really strange like that. And when they talk about how this is going to be the last season, the last Deb season, it always feels like no matter when you watch the movie, it always the next season is going to be the last season.
You know what? Edward Clement's TV was black and white, and I noticed that, and I was thinking, what's up with that? And,
makes much more sense. The Yule log.
That cinches it. It's got to be a period movie with an unspecified year.
And the way they talk about going to France and things like that, it seems very.
come on. College students of all times talk about visiting Europe, and they go visit Europe.
Yeah, but now they go to Ibiza, right? And end up a joke in some lame.
Well, now the middle classes visit Europe after or after college.
They
teach English in Japan.
The girls are kind of funny because what is it? Basically, you have the lead, Caroline Farina is kind of the lead, and it's the most drama in the movie is about her being in love with Clemens.
Yeah, then, but she kind of disappears at the end. I thought of Clements much more as the main character.
Well, yeah, but when he turns into the romantic leading man who's going to save her from the European baron titled aristocratic jerk, who is kind of like that's the other strange thing that Stillman does is he introduces all these characters by talking about them almost in that Kevin Smith way where you talk about Walt Flanagan and his dog and then
unlike Smith, I mean, you hear about these characters for a long time and then they eventually show up.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Then they show up and then, I mean, that's kind of it's just Rick von Schlonecker. He sounds like an evil German from, you know, a serial in the 40s.
Yeah,
and
kind of a W.C. Fields name.
And then you find out that he's terrible, and it's in the humanizing part of Chris Eigman's performance where there's this hilarious scene where he it's not hilarious the first time you see it. He tells his group of friends about how he's been talking about how he hates this guy, and the reason he hates him is because, you know, he basically raped this girl. And then she ended up killing herself because she was emotionally disturbed. And then he later tells, like, immediately subsequently to the scene, he tells Clements that it's a bunch of bullshit. You know, he made it up.
Yeah.
And then in the big confrontation with this guy, you find out that it's true. And all he did was really change the name. And it totally humanizes him and paints him in this totally different light that he's still totally absurd. And I'm saying totally a lot. Because he's terrified that his stepmother's actually going to kill him and he won't shut up about it. But then he's humanized in this way that,
I feel like he was kind of cast because he has a 19. Okay. So it's not, this movie didn't take place in the '30s, but they party like it's 1939 anyways. I feel like he was kind of cast because he's got that huge dimple in his chin and it's makes him like Clark Gable or something.
I think also cause he, really delivers Stillman's sort of egocentric dialogue perfectly, but
yeah, you know, I'm eager to see Barcelona and Last Days of Disco because I'd like to know if his dialogue is that stilted normally or if it was just the. I'm not really being derogatory saying stilted. I just mean mannered rather in the way that these characters are mannered. I guess so because you know what I hear is protagonists are all kind of. From this set, social set.
Yeah, it's more like Last Days of Disco's more dramatic, but it still has it. And Barcelona has some of it, like some really great funny stuff. But almost like he knew what people liked from this one, so he did that in Barcelona. Whereas Last Days of Disco is more sort of an organic mix. And that's a definite period he's going for and things like that. Because the late 90s, they tried to do the whole, I mean, Last Days of Disco, Boogie Nights, 54, Blow.
200 Cigarettes.
That was a period piece?
Yeah, it was set in like New Year's Eve of 80 or 81.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I couldn't even tell. Wow.
I've never seen it. I did.
Me either. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so back
I suspect
to...
I suspect it's bad.
So, and then the character, sort of complicated character relationships are revealed through this, and the way Stillman, it only takes place over probably a week and a half. I mean, I think it probably only takes place over a 2 week break. It almost seems like, because every day, the first set of parties are, he goes to one party he wasn't going to go to, then they drag him to the next one, then he's their friend, and then by the next week after Christmas, he finds out that they aren't really friends. They just know each other, and the whole thing breaks apart as they sort of go their separate ways. Which is very strange, because we never do find out how the group formed in the first place. So I smell CGI prequel.
Well, if he was willing to do a novelization / sequel to Last Days of Disco, who knows? He's pretty idiosyncratic. Apparently he moved to France, just like his protagonists are off to do. And he's been there for more or less the last 10 years, and he just moved back. So maybe he's getting a little closer to another movie.
To getting to work. Well, he's got to be. He's almost 60 at this point. I mean...
Yeah, God, I had no idea. I assumed he was, you know, from the Tarantino-Smith generation. Or even Soderbergh, a little bit older, but still.
There's Wes Anderson. We're comparing him to Wes Anderson. The thing we're forgetting is, even though Wes Anderson has sort of become the new New York, the new WASP New York filmmaker, Wes Anderson's from Texas. I mean, that's kind of the thing. Is this Bottle Rocket was shot in Texas, and it doesn't have any of that sort of thing that he got with the Magnificent Ambersons and sort of repeated. And everybody just not Ambersons, obviously. Royal Tenenbaums.
Is basically the Magnificent Ambersons.
So
he made for modern audiences. He's. Yeah, God, I forget that. He's from Texas. Bottle Rocket has more in common with a Coen Brothers movie, like Raising Arizona, than it does Metropolitan.
But apparently Metropolitan took him 4 years to write.
And he was working at a fashion magazine in New York or something like that.
Yeah.
Something with, you know, pretty frequent exposure. I don't know, biographical information about him, handily available on IMDb and Wikipedia, didn't explain much. I mean, because I couldn't really tell if he grew up rich or not, and that's
he was a Democrat. Well, here's what's funny: he's a son of impoverished debutante and a Democratic politician. But if you Google for him the right way, you'll find a bunch of people saying that only Republicans can like Whit Stillman movies.
Really?
Yeah, if you Google for Whit Stillman and Republican, there's like something about, I like the Whit Stillman movie, but do I have to be a Republican to get it? And I think I read that before I watched Metropolitan, and you get done with it and you're like, what do you... And I'm like, is there some subtext I'm missing about it?
I would bet that he grew up with money and lost it or something like that, because, you know, otherwise you wouldn't have the Edward Clements characters, what makes him different from the rest, and the obsession that the hyperverbal Taylor Nichols character has with, you know, this doomedness of maybe this is the end for their social strata, for their class. Maybe America's getting a little less classist or something. he's kind of onto it, and he's saying, you know, us UBS. Oh, we haven't even mentioned that. Yeah, this character invents a new trendy acronym for his social class, just like the trendy acronyms yuppie and prep or abbreviations preppy, all that stuff. He calls them UBS, which are urban ho bourgeoisie, and it's all in French, so it has a ring to it.
And they comment on that he's trying to make it seem, they're trying to seem less pretentious by using it all French. And there's also this hilarious thing about how Nichols, his first rant is about how the bourgeoisie are underappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, everybody makes fun of him, but where would everybody be?
He was disappointed when he went to see the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie.
Well, that would actually place it, because that would make it 73 or so, yeah. Early 70s. But yeah, so yeah. He's like, finally, somebody gets us. But no, they don't. And then it turns into this whole thing about they're arguing about how the surrealists feel about this, and it's
oh, the surrealists were just a bunch of social climbers.
Yeah. And then what is it, Clemens is a 4A-ist, and it makes you want to read about not just I really want to read a book about this farm experiment that didn't work out, because somehow Stillman makes all these strange references, and they're not pop culture references, but
yeah, no, these are the references of preppies who have actually had a formal education where they learn about Greek and Roman history and what have you, like actual history.
And it somehow kind of encourages, I don't know, it makes you wonder about this thing versus pop culture references, which if you miss them, you either think they're idiotic, or if you get them, you think they're cheap and idiotic. So it's like...
Yeah, no, that's the real, you know, whatever, maybe that's the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, is that, yeah, they do value education and being cultured, and there's nothing wrong with that in of itself. In fact, it's pretty attractive.
And I mean, the other thing is, this movie's from 90, so the IMDb describes it as one of the best independent films of the 90s, so that's kind of...
That's stupid, but you could say that it's a very 90s movie, and it's ahead of its time, and it kind of signals what 90s movies are going to be like.
But it takes them 5 years, 4 or 5 years to catch up.
Right.
And I really can't think of anybody who has done something like Metropolitan... that really doesn't have much of a dramatic force or any big set pieces. Lots of the action happens off screen. You find out, you don't find out, they're drinking through the entire movie and it's never referenced.
And just like a Thin Man movie, they never really act that drunk.
Except the one guy.
Except the one guy who's a terrible drunk and pukes and stuff.
And then he's got like the saddest... sort of story arc at the end when he's sobering up and drinking Coca-Colas with aspirins, right. Which even gets an insert shot, which I thought was really funny. He's like, you know, I'm boring. I don't have any reason to be up if I'm not drinking. I don't think I was funny when I was drunk. It just seemed like I was funny. I'm just going to go home. And it's just really... You know,
It's like New Yorker humor if New Yorker cartoons acknowledged alcoholism amongst the class of people who read New Yorkers cartoons. Anyways, yeah, he's like a young Glenn Shadix, if you want to picture him, if you haven't seen the movie.
And then who's the guy they talk to at the bar?
Oh, yeah, he's funny, and Taylor Nichols gets him to start using his UB meme. Yeah, I don't quite know. He's good, though. He's almost like a...
It says this is his only movie. Man at Bar, Dick Edwards, played by Roger W. Kirby. This is his only credit.
He seems like he probably is the character that he played, and Stillman just knew him and casted him.
Yeah, it's just, you know, this sad sort of... not even sad. It's just you're not going to be...
resigned.
You're not going to be sensational when you thought you were going to be. And it's... at that point, the whole movie... I don't know.
The movie's got kind of a novelistic structure in that it will... you know, have a character who exists just for a scene, but who has really heavy dialogue with one of the main cast, and you know, it's probably the influence of Stillman's upbringing, but it also shows in how the characters talk a lot about "have you read this, have you read that," and which leads to a really funny line from Chris Eigenman, which I won't spoil about, or not Chris Eigenman, Edward Clements about.
You already said it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Fine.
No, it's great.
And then, of course, then you find out the girl made him start reading books.
Yeah, that's her influence on him.
So, obviously, he's coming around to her, and not too late. So there, I just spoiled the whole damn movie for you.
And
he even makes friends with his romantic rival for her affections.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, the movie ends really well for everybody, and you're anticipating a darker ending. Oh, speaking of which, of unknown origin. Now here's a movie that...
is that our segue?
Yeah, I'm taking a hard left.
Okay. So see Metropolitan. Okay. There.
Yeah, it's on Netflix streaming. If you got Netflix, yeah. Check it out.
Yep.
this is a movie, you know, okay. Peter Weller, I mean, there's more than one connection. Peter Weller is supposed to be a New York yuppie who...
But he made it on his own. He came up.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't like those other guys who went to Yale. He wasn't a Yaley.
Right, and he's in a battle of wits and survival and all that stuff with a rat, a big rat that's invaded his apartment. And... it doesn't quite, you know, it's really well directed. I can totally see how George Cosmatos, who directed Rambo, First Blood Part 2, which most people have probably seen, but he's directed some other stuff, and I haven't really seen it. This is probably his first movie that I've seen after Rambo. He's a good director. I can totally see how he'd be very capable of making a good movie, but the thing about this one is that it doesn't really raise... It's got a simple plot, but it doesn't raise the dramatic stakes the way something like... I guess the first comparison would probably be to Spielberg's Duel, and the way that that's just about a guy who's dueling, like the title, with a crazy trucker, and it's that simple, but all this added mythical weight gets added to it by the end of the movie. And also... this one of unknown origin, it kind of pulls its punches at the end, and I can't really call it a bad movie. It's definitely better than a lot of movies we've seen lately, but it's just kind of okay in the end, kind of mediocre, because as well directed as it is and as great as Peter Weller is, it feels a little too pointless. And it was made by the CFDC, the Canadian Film Development Corporation, the company that was around and that was created by the Socialist Canadian Film Board to be a little more make some more commercial ventures, i.e., make more horror movies, and that's how David Cronenberg got his start. And it didn't last, but I mean, while it was around, you saw more movies coming out of Canada that were sort of genre movies like this one, where it's basically an American company gets awesome tax breaks to go in and make their movie where they double Nova Scotia as New York City. And
with some insert shots, I feel like some of it.
True, yeah.
Yeah. And the Canadian cast, it's before, I think, necessarily filming in Canada became a pejorative.
Yeah,
because Jennifer Dale, who plays his assistant, sort of reminds you of what's her face from Suspiria, which I kind of think was the point.
Elizabeth Shue. Oh no, sorry. She was also in Shock Treatment and blanking.
Jessica Harper. Yeah.
Yeah.
She kind of looks the same. And
it's true.
Yeah. So
and then you got this movie introduces Shannon Tweed as per the credits, and it actually is one of those movies where the introducing credit does introduce someone that you've heard of, and Shannon Tweed is of course Canadian. So.
Right. Is this before or after she was in Playboy?
Well, I don't know, but
it's after.
She gets clothless often in the movie.
Yeah, that's how she and Peter Weller and her have sex a bunch. To the point where he has a nightmare that because he's having sex with her, his son is going to eat rat poison and she's going to get attacked by a rat. The thing I thought was funny is she was 26 in this, which means she would have been 17 when the son was born. I just did the math.
Yeah.
That doesn't really work. She does not play a mom very well.
She's obviously a little bit too young for Weller.
Yeah, and a little, yeah. Even though she's only 10 years, well, I don't even know if I believe that Weller would have had his kid at that point.
Well, Weller is—I mean, he's young in RoboCop, and this is 5 years before RoboCop. And but the thing about Peter Weller is that he actually is an android, so he sort of, you know, his porcelain face looks the same no matter what age. I think, as far as I've seen.
So. I did have some problems with the constant Steadicam for emphasis in terms of Cosmodus' direction. I really like the music for whatever reason. I never looked up the name of the guy who did it, Kenneth Wanberg. I thought he did a good job. And there's supposed to be all sorts of Jaws references in this.
Well, yeah. There are,
but
he looks at a book of you know, medical diagrams of rats, and I think he
all the horrors they've done to people.
The pages are reflected in his glasses, I think.
But
wouldn't it have been great if his boss was played by Roy Scheider? The boss kind of looked like Roy Scheider too, except he was just some, you know, no name Canadian supporting actor.
Yeah, and 83 was still too early for Roy Scheider to be doing this kind of thing. 89, 87. He would have been there, but 83 was Blue Thunder. And my thing about the movie is that it misses pretty much... Well, my problem with the rat is I don't think the rat's supposed to be giant-sized. I think they used big models to make it scarier. Because when you see it running through the walls, it's a regular-sized rat.
Yeah, and at some point I thought that they were trying to do a psychological... This is when I thought the movie had a point. I thought they were trying to have some psychological effect where the rat gradually gets bigger as the movie goes on. But no, what it really is, you know, they have a puppet rat, and the puppet rat is pretty big. And you see more of the puppet rat as the movie goes on.
But,
and it's too big to be running through the walls a la Steadicam like it does.
So, okay... the movie not having a point. So here's the basic plot of the movie is that Peter Weller's family goes on vacation. They want him to go, but they can't go because he's got a big work thing to do, which is a big deal because he's been working his way up from the bottom to earn the respect of Shannon Tweed's father, who's rich enough that he'd buy them this brownstone that they, and this is where you find out that Peter Weller's really a man's man. He did all the work in the house himself, and you could probably fill...
He's got a stake in this house.
Yeah,
he's not just
going
to move out if there were a big rat or something.
So then he's working on the work thing, and this rat's driving him nuts.
He's got a big project at the office.
Big project.
Big project, yeah.
And so... There's like this strange period before he goes totally batshit nuts over the rat where he's still doing his work while the rat is destroying the house around him and he's taking the time out to do his work, which I found a little problematic logically. But eventually he's in a skull cap sitting on the stairs of the baseball telling people to get out of his house because he's got to think like the rat.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't even get... Okay, so when the kid leaves at the beginning, he's got a little cage. Which I thought was going to come back that his pet rat got away. There's no reference to the kid having a pet. there's, I mean, this, there's this scene where Peter Weller's like, there are no rats in this house. And it's like, the hamster could be in the house. What was in the cage that the kid takes with him on vacation skiing, which makes absolutely no sense, that the kid would take the thing in the car. Also, they get their car in New York really quick.
They forgot they weren't supposed to be in Nova Scotia.
Right. And I own rats. I'm just going to put this out here. I own rats. So I have like certain problems with the images perpetuated by this film of rats. But the other, but even dismissing all of that, he kills all of the rats' babies, and then she tries to kill him. That could have happened at the beginning by accident, and there would have been like some sort of narrative arc where he's, you know, dealing with this psycho rat after he accidentally killed the babies. No, there's nothing like that. It's just a throwaway. He just kills the babies.
A lack of narrative arc is a good way to put it, because I mean, Peter Weller carries the movie by not doing the same thing over and over. He kind of gives his character an arc that the story doesn't give him, because the escalation of events between him and the rat is a little out of order. But Peter Weller kind of makes it work. But, you know, unfortunately, right, there still isn't a point, because there's no progression to the battle between him and the rat. Even by the end, it kind of feels like sometimes he's a little crazier than other times. Like you said, when he's yelling at people to leave us alone, you know?
Yeah, oh, the leave us alone thing, yeah.
I mean, I think he has a normal scene, a few normal scenes after that. And more to the point, by the end of the movie, spoiler alert, he does kill the rat, but it feels really unsatisfying because everything's okay. In fact, he doesn't even lose his job over this obsession. Nor does he lose his family, nor does he lose anything, actually.
Right, speaking of his family, there's the incredible weird thing where he makes out with his secretary that doesn't get explored at all.
Yeah, I mean, I would almost suspect, this was based on a novel, I would almost suspect that the novel had a dark ending where all these subplots ended badly, because you've got this prime subplot of, you know, this kind of random flirtation and relationship between him and his secretary that his boss even notices, you know, which he would think is the reason that he's been slacking at work. But, you know, like I said, he doesn't lose his job, and there's no confrontation between the secretary and his wife, or they even tease you with a scene where the secretary comes to the house and she's walking through the house like, you know, the rat is going to attack her any second, and then it doesn't.
And then there's the neighboring, maintenance guy who has the building next door. The maintenance guy at the building next door who apparently does repairs at all the buildings in the neighborhood for everybody.
And he's an expert exterminator.
Right, he was in the army. Unlike Peter Weller, which was sort of an interesting scene, I guess. He doesn't die either, and he's the perfect guy to die.
Right, because he's just some fat, mustached Canadian character actor.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, the rat doesn't kill anybody. It kills the cat, which I'm not sure I believe.
Yeah.
It kills a stray cat that's been living on the streets and surviving, and the rat's basically a badass because, well, we don't know. They tell us all these things rats can do, and that's supposed to, like, well, a rat's scary because it can chew through concrete. Well, that's not really that scary. I mean, it's not like the rat's chewing through Supermax and letting out all the freaking serial killers. The rat's chewing through, you know, pillows. And it doesn't matter. And
yeah, it would have been. They kind of just try to, yeah, right. There's nothing supernatural, nor, you know.
All rats are bad, and this rat is bad because it's in the house.
Right. It would have been totally fine if, you know, like you said, the revelation at the end, it was the kid's pet who escaped or something, if they'd pulled an alligator and had it been mutated in the, you know, those dangerous New York sewers by the toxic waste that's always,
I mean, if
it's
they,
always flowing around in there in the movie.
There's this weird scene where Peter Weller's bitching about his wife and his kid.
Oh, which?
Remember, it's one of the scenes with the secretary. Not, I don't think it's the one where they make out. I think it's the one after that. But before, when he goes batshit nuts and tells her to get out of the house, he's talking about how his wife's rich or something. And meanwhile, it's in this New York brownstone that looks like, you know, a set out of Friends. It's so absurd. And so he has this whole thing about how his wife expects this and what's he going to do and blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like, well, if the rat was the escaped kid's rat and it was like a metaphor for his something.
Yeah, this rat,
there's
this
nothing.
Rat, this rat needed to be a metaphor for something and it wasn't.
And I mean, the way they make the rat so awful is they show pictures of like a kid with a rat bite on the nose. And that's why rats are... that's how they set it up. I mean, it's kind of like...
This movie's anti-rat.
It's very anti-rat. And it's strange because if Jaws is the... sort of what they were going for, Jaws with a rat, Jaws never did that. They never demonized the shark. Even during the gross shark pictures, that was... that was... It's somehow different.
You almost feel bad for the shark that they catch that they think is Jaws, but it's not.
There are no other rats in this either besides the babies that Peter Weller kills.
Yeah, and that's a really odd scene because it's really graphic. It almost looks like they killed real rats, rat babies.
I'm sure they did. I mean...
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure the ASPCA doesn't care. The CSPCA or whatever.
The Canadian credits are so funny because they don't have anything like the ASPCA. They just have this very sincere note saying, like, it was our utmost concern of the animal's safety during this production. Really, believe us. We promise.
Yeah.
But no official, no organization approved this movie, and they probably did kill those baby rats because, you know, who cares? Peter Weller grew up in Texas, man. He's done stuff like that before, growing up.
He's done stuff like that before.
Well, he knew how to twirl a gun for RoboCop. They didn't have to teach him that.
Yeah, it's kind of strange that his career started only a few years before this. I mean, really. Anyway, so, yeah, back to... Then you have these weird... people that you recognize. Well, I guess the only people you really recognize are Peter Weller, Shannon Tweed, depending on how much Playboy you read and how many episodes of Frasier you've seen, because she was Frasier's girlfriend on there. And I guess she's got a reality show now. But anyway, and Maury Shaken's in it with hair, and he's playing a Yaley. And Maury Shaken... he's been in tons of stuff. I'm trying to find something famous that people would recognize him from. Meatballs 3, does that work? What was he in? I mean, he's been in tons of stuff. He was in, he was the guy cooking the grits, I think, in My Cousin Vinny would probably be the most popular thing from 10 years ago. But I guess he's Canadian because he's in a lot of, he's from Brooklyn. Anyway, he's in it, and I saw his name in the credits, and I'm like, oh, okay, so he's going to have a big role. No, nobody really has a big role in this movie. I mean, not even the second-billed secretary who Peter Weller makes out with, who saves his job and all sorts of stuff. And because she and Peter Weller's boss sort of take care of him when he's going batshit crazy over the rat. And so you're left with Peter Weller in his house, which is not a very interesting house to destroy either. Is kind of my other thing. And it's like the unfinished basement. If they rebuilt the house from the bottom up, you would have thought the basement would have been finished. That's one thing. And then the red herring of the third floor isn't finished. So there'd be this big spooky third floor scene. Nah. There's nothing like that. They go down to the basement. There's a model of the house.
Yeah.
Not even a good scene with that. I mean...
Yeah, he's got a model of the house in the basement like he's Terry O'Quinn or something, and it's only there because you know it's going to get destroyed, and then it does, and it's almost like Cosmatos is going, look, metaphor, and it's too literal a metaphor, and we needed a meteor metaphor for the rat.
Yeah, so, and yeah.
Not only is the rat not thematically significant in any way, but the way Weller finally kills it is unspectacular. He doesn't. It's no last-minute save. It's no sudden fit of sudden burst of inspiration. He finally gets the chance to hit it with his baseball bat, and he does. And then even when it's dead, we don't get to look at it because we never get a good look at it. Even with a puppet, it's mostly just like. There were a couple of scenes that were effective, certainly, where he's in direct combat with the rat, because Cosmatos does know how to shoot it where you don't see it, but you feel like it's there, like if it's, at the other side of the door trying to squeeze through or something.
But it's not trying to squeeze through, it's trying to break the door down.
Oh, right, because it's demon hell rat, only it's not. all rats are demon hell rats.
This reminded me of Night of the Demon and how we had talked about how in Night of the Demon, or is it Curse of the Demon? It's Night of the Demon, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, if you hadn't seen it, it would have just made it sort of a cute narrative thing, whereas seeing it, it sort of makes it something else. I think in this, it had to be a giant rat. It's not interesting when it's a little rat because the story's not there. I think if it had been a rat the size of a German Shepherd, that would have been freaking scary.
Yeah, like Night Shift, but a good movie or something.
Like if it had come out of the
Graveyard Shift.
If it had come out of the toilet and been big. I mean, they could have still done the thing where you didn't see it, but that it wasn't just supposed to be a regular rat that they were.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were both expecting something more exploitative from the director of Rambo and Cobra, but this was a little too classy, actually.
Which Rambo did he direct? I can't remember.
Oh, First Blood Part 2. Rambo, oh, First Blood Part 2. Yeah.
Written by James Cameron.
And this was written by a guy named Brian Taggart, who wrote Poltergeist 3, and we were counting on that for the badness, but I don't know. Apparently, Poltergeist 3 had like 5 writers, so.
Oh my god. Poltergeist 3 was filmed in my hometown, some of it. I was like, really? Oh, wasn't that filmed in Canada? No, it was filmed like 3 blocks from me as growing up. And everybody was like, wow, and then nobody ever saw Poltergeist 3. And all it was known for was that girl dying. Like, right 3 weeks after or whatever. The Poltergeist curse. Anyway, yeah, Brian Taggart, whose IMDb picture has him grinning, which obviously he uploaded himself. I'd actually heard of Visiting Hours because William Shatner's in it.
I think everybody remembers that poster where the hospital lights form the shape of a skull.
He did the Wanted Dead or Alive remake or sequel with Rutger Hauer and Gene Simmons, which I never saw, but it had that poster.
He's got B TV movie credentials. He did Trucks, which was the literal remake, the serious non-comedy remake of Maximum Overdrive.
Right.
And, Omen 4, which was made for TV and had a little girl instead of Damien. And then he did V. He did a bunch of episodes of V, the series. So, yeah, I mean, what do you expect, really?
Yeah. Well, I guess
not,
he did.
He's not terrible, but he's just,
That was kind of, I mean, the thing is, the dialogue is so talky that it sort of I think that if Cosmatos had been able to direct dialogue better, it would have been a lot more interesting, because the dialogue's really talking, and none of the acting's really bad, and so they're sort of getting out these incredibly expositional lines where they're explaining everything they're going to do, because we actually don't get to see it, because Peter Weller's too busy in the library getting freaked out over rats. That's the other thing, is Peter Weller's never really defined as this guy who's going to get obsessed and screw up a dinner party in his honor or something because he was reading about rats. I mean, that's kind of weak-willed. Really.
Although Peter Weller is, I mean, he's real funny, and there are some movies make better use of him as a comic actor than others. But I mean, part of how he makes this movie work is, and how it wouldn't have, you know, how we would be a lot harder on it if it didn't star Peter Weller, I think, is that he, you know, he makes little asides to himself during his, you know, long, you know, war of attrition with this rat. Like when the lights dim, he, you know, looks up and goes, "Oh, I was wondering when you'd get around to that."
The thing I was waiting for was, and it was hinted at, I mean, there's everything in this movie that could be good was hinted at and never followed up on, is the, what is it, the Stockholm Syndrome? When he and the rat sort of form a codependent relationship.
Yeah, when he yells out the window, "Leave us alone."
Right. I mean, that would have been awesome. And they don't do that at all. Instead, he yells out the window and you get a reaction shot from the Canadian character actor guy going, "I'm going to go check on him." So he goes to check on him and you're like, "Oh God, the rat's going to kill this guy finally." No, the rat doesn't kill him.
Yeah, he's going to kill him, and then Peter Weller's going to be framed for the murder.
I mean,
yeah.
Just anything. I mean, if the rat had gone, I think there was one scene where they shoot shoes in the office, walking down the hall. I'm like, "Ooh, the rat followed him to work. This is going to be awesome."
I kind of, yeah, if this movie were as exploitative as The Hand, then
yeah, that's
would have had a movie like The Hand, except good and with a rat.
Yeah, and I mean, can you imagine one tiny rat that's filmed huge in effect shots terrorizing an entire office? That'd be awesome. It can chew through concrete, after all.
Follows Peter Weller across the country, inexplicably.
Could have hidden in his bag. I think he even had a bag. He had a bag. And I'm like, the rat's in the bag. No, the rat's not in the bag. It's basically anything you anticipate in this from having seen sort of exploitative genre movies never happens. So
the only kind of genre moments happen as dream sequences. And the first one is a surprise kind of when it happens, but the second one, you realize it's going to be a dream sequence before it gets there.
What was the first one?
When it burst out of the birthday cake at his kid's birthday. The rat.
Oh, see.
And then later he has the longer dream that you mentioned where
his kid eats the rat poison. If the kid had eaten the rat poison and died, that would have made it good. Because the kid was really obnoxious. I mean, let's not forget the kid was really obnoxious. Really
like
grasping for attention.
He's like an annoying Danny Lloyd.
Yeah, he was really grasping for attention, possibly because all Peter Weller and Shannon Tweed ever did was have sex, which could have had a very interesting scene of the kid being traumatized by that. But we haven't talked about the end yet. We mentioned that it's a happy ending. So he destroys their house.
And their fancy-ass house. They arrive at the house back from vacation. They see Peter Weller. He's all suited up like RoboCop in his rat-killing gear. And they're like, "Oh, what's with the funny outfit? Oh, nice to see you, honey. Oh, kiss, kiss." And then they, you know, the camera stays outside the house as they walk inside. And what happened? "I had a party."
Ha ha ha.
The end.
That actually kind of reminded me of Black Christmas. Just how, you know, they thought they had a good ending, and it's just like, no.
Are you talking about the original or the remake?
The original. How it ends with the psycho up in the room or whatever, and then the credits roll, and it's just like, nah, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I think with Black Christmas.
It was a lot better than this, though.
Well, yeah, but that, I mean. Yeah, but also Black Christmas had the excuse that originally that wasn't the ending, and they inserted that. I don't know what the hell the excuse is for this. I don't think there's a commentary track on the...
Oh my God, no, there is. It's a commentary track that's a composite of Cosmatos and Weller talking about it.
Oh my God.
I know. What an age we live in. Some of these movies we talk about, I can't believe that, you know, that they put some effort into... But like The Hand, yeah. Coincidentally, God, Oliver Stone was actually willing to go back and talk about that one.
Yeah, I think they probably paid him $4.50.
And you'd think, and you know, Cosmatos maybe, but I mean, you'd think Peter Weller might have just, you know, viewed this as a stepping stone or whatever. But whatever, I haven't listened to it, and who knows where they got the audio for the commentary track. But you know, yeah, if you want to hear those guys talk about the movie, the DVD is out there.
That's crazy. I guess the movie does a pretty good job of doing New York as Canada, or Canada as New York.
Yeah, they found a black woman.
Yeah, I noticed that.
New York has black people.
We gotta have a black person in it because there are black people in New York. Oddly, Gotham City doesn't have any black people, and I was reminded of that today. But
although Peter Weller is as condescending to the one black person in Nova Scotia as anyone in The Dark Knight. Oh, come on. When he says, you know, Alice or whatever her name is, there just ain't enough hours in the day. No one understands.
Yeah, but he was sharing with her. She understood him, kind of. She was concerned, which I thought was going to be another subplot, that people were actually concerned about him, as opposed to just going away after he told them to leave them alone. Because does he ever say he's having a rat problem? I don't think he does.
Yeah, I guess only the guy next door knows about it.
And then the psycho other guy who really isn't defined how Peter Weller found him. And then, I mean, the other problem with rats is you can't get an exterminator in New York. And then, except the next day, you can get an exterminator in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I had a problem with the rat opening the turntable. I had some logic problems with that, because how did the rat get it closed again without some sort of damage or something?
Yeah, that reminds me. This is the first movie I've seen in a long time, and possibly the only movie before or ever where I heard an actor speak the words turntable platter. Pick it up, it's under the turntable platter.
Now, while you're doing your Peter Weller voice, you do have to admit that he does it with a little bit more dramatic emphasis.
Yeah, a little less RoboCop. Sorry, I've been doing RoboCop longer than I've been doing Peter Weller impressions. No matter where you go, there you are. You're coming with me. sees that rat, he goes, "Your move, creep."
Bad language makes for bad feelings. See, I can't hate RoboCop 2 because of that line. That's awesome. I mean, besides it,
go
you know,
a refrigerator.
Besides that, it's got a bigger budget and the special effects are still stop motion and good, and Irvin Kershner can direct. It's got that line, and that line's just like, that's perfect. And the costume was better. If you listen to the Criterion track, they talk about not aesthetically better, but they were able to do more with it.
Right.
And then by the third one, they were back to the ghetto budget. So.
Yeah.
So back to this, and I think what else? I said I liked the music. Cinematography's okay. Like I said, the inserts they do sort of suggest that he's working at the World Trade Center, but not. Like, I think he's working at the World Trade Center of Nova Scotia. Because they sort of have these shots of this World Trade Center looking like plaza. And he works in a building that looks like the World Trade Center. And it's sort of, he looks out his office window and you see the other tower. And so it seems very, I mean, that's what my first thought was, until later in the movie you find out that it's really a kind of L-shaped building, possibly. But whatever. They do a decent job of it. Like I said, it's before Canada became a pejorative when it comes to where you make your movie.
It's when Canadian movies could almost look as real as American movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they had gotten a couple more recognizable actors. Because Peter Weller in this is pre-Buckaroo Banzai, so nobody would have known who he was, really. Mm-hmm. So we're only watching it knowing who Peter Weller is. So just imagine what it would have been like back then.
Yeah, I would have thought, that guy has a weird face.
Isn't that James Woods? Yeah. he and James Woods ought to do a movie together before.
They ought to play brothers, yeah.
Or they had to play people who keep getting confused with each other. I don't know. Whatever. So, of unknown origin. It sounds like you liked it more than I did, but then again, you know, I do have the rats. So,
yeah,
I was offended.
Oh, no. If I were a rat lover, I would hate this movie. Definitely. Although, you know, I mean, what's your opinion on Willard and the rest of the rat movies? Food of the Gods 2? All those? Or just Food of the Gods, I'm sorry.
You know, the last time I saw Food of the Gods, I haven't seen Willard. Food of the Gods, well, isn't Willard somewhat positive? I mean, even though they're creepy.
Yes.
It's positive about the relationship between man and rat. You know, whatever. It's just, the way they demonized the rat was just really cheap and lame.
Yeah, it was more, it's casual, it's not giant. Like we've been saying, it's not a giant rat. It's not.
There's a magazine article on this I really want to sort of make mock Ratatouille copies and put them in things. It's called, what is it? What do they call the rat in that article? Like, Companion of the Devil. The Rat.
Yeah. Somehow I don't think that's an objective scientific article.
And they're going on about all this stuff. And that was an interesting thing. How much money would rats chewing up a grain company's grain cost that company? But they never go anywhere with it. It's just some idiotic statistic. It's just some, you know, factoid that Peter Weller mentions at this dinner party from hell where...
And just to bring it maybe all around to the title of Unknown Origin, the book it was based on had a more generic title. I think it was called The Visitor. Of Unknown Origin, you see it when Weller's looking at a library slide of a rat and says of unknown origin, you know, species wise.
Is that what you thought that meant? I thought that meant the
Oh, the photo?
No, I thought that meant the where the term came from.
Well, okay, could have. But I mean, Weller's obsession, you know, when he's talking about how rats destroy so much food and the bubonic plague and all that, I mean, it's so stupid when people talk about that because, you know, there were a lot less people when the bubonic plague wiped out 2/3 of Europe, so not really as impressive by modern standards. But anyways, when he's getting obsessed with rats in general, it's another missed opportunity to... I mean, H.P. Lovecraft was afraid of rats, and he knew how to sort of relate them as well as, you know, sea creatures, these kind of natural animals to... He knew how to relate them to sort of more primordial fears of animals, and that's another missed opportunity there.
Yeah. Let's see.
And you know what? If Cosmatos and Cosmatos were a little more gonzo, again, with the lack of exploitation complaint, it could have been like a... It could have... Or maybe not a whole movie, but it could have built up to a confrontation along lines of... Evil Dead 2, where Sam Raimi's or Bruce Campbell's battling his own hand, and it's crawling around, and we've got the camera on the floor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that was my complaint about the hand as well.
I swear I just saw something that I wanted to comment on really quick. Rats have been... Okay, that was it. So, you know, as a rat owner, I've mentioned over the, you know, people from the West Coast, don't freak out when you say you had a rat. I'm from Chicago. I freaked out when my wife wanted to get rats. I talked to people from the East Coast. They totally freak out. A friend of mine from New York's like, you cannot convince a New Yorker that a rat is cute. So it's sort of unbelievable to me that Peter Weller, as a New Yorker, would have absolutely no experience with rats.
Yep.
Whatsoever, because there's sort of a thing there, like cockroaches, you know, you just have to deal with it.
When he's doing that research on rats, it's like he's just learned what rats are. He's just learned that they exist.
Well, yeah, because they play it like that Jaws scene where, oh my god, this is so amazing, I never knew about this before, and it's like, did you know that rats, you know, can chew off somebody's face? And they go for the soft parts of people. That's what the guy next door tells him, is they go for the eyes. And I'm kind of like, you know, even when you watch something, a documentary about how rats are, you know, they're out of control population-wise, this and that, it's never like, oh my god, and then the rat attacked me. It's, oh, and then the rat ate my freaking turkey dinner. and sat there and kind of laughed at me because he knew I wasn't going to do anything. It's never like it tried to chew out my eyeballs or something. So, yeah. And then, yeah, so.
Peter Weller kind of does movies where he deals with vermin, doesn't he? Naked Lunch had had cockroaches. And
Emil in RoboCop was vermin.
Common urban plagues.
Yeah, so.
Goons, cockroaches, and rats.
And if I actually don't care, but if we were a more considerate thing, I would link to, I guess after Ratatouille, people started buying pet rats for Christmas, and there was an article in the New York Times about how, like, a pet rat is essentially like a little dog in terms of how sweet it is and how loyal it is to its owner. So, could they have introduced that and had some weird relationship between the two of them? Yeah. Could it be some psycho replacement of the wife? Yeah. But we don't do that.
Yeah. Once again, we're just describing how the movie could have been better.
Now, they had this is totally something, you know. Forget remaking The Shining as a 12-hour miniseries. Remake of Unknown Origin with, you know, better script, and you can still make it in Canada, whatever.
Yeah, make it with the same script, but just have a few people die, and you're in business. Oh, and put it in 3D.
Exactly, 3D. Especially the way Cosmo, I don't think he's worked lately. He could direct it.
Yeah, he'd be good for 3D. He could do the next Rambo movie in 3D.
No, I think Stallone's going to be directing the next Rambo.
That's right, yeah, Stallone only directs himself now. That's right.
Well, it's the only success he's had in 1990. Yeah, it would be 20-some years. It's the only success he's had since, you know, the 80s is directing himself.
And the classic Jay Sherman critic John Lovitz line, we've seen his career rise and fall and rise again. How could anyone survive Rhinestone? He's not human. Anyway,
that's out on DVD, isn't it? I need to see that. That was
because
whenever I saw it on TV, I always saw the same episode rerun over and over again. But anyway, next week,
we are watching another horror movie, only a real horror movie and a good one. Return of the Living Dead. Dan O'Bannon wrote and directed this one. It was. He wrote Alien, and he's had a lot of screenwriting credits in genre movies, but he only ever directed two movies, this and an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation a couple years later called The Resurrected. But I've seen this movie many times over the years, and I literally notice something new every time I see it. So it's one of those movies I'm really looking forward to.
Now, this is in title-only sequel to Night of the Living Dead? Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, all will be explained when you see it, but legally, yes, Romero had nothing to do with this one. But one of the producers and a story credit goes to John Russo, who is a co-producer on Night of Living Dead, and spoiler Romero, and we'll explain, we'll touch on the legal battle on that.
And then our bad movie is going to be, speaking of someone whose career has risen and fallen many a time and is currently on a low ebb until the next Die Hard movie, we're going to be watching The Last Boy Scout.
1991 buddy action movie from the golden shower age of buddy action movies. I'm expecting lots of homoeroticism.
Now, have you seen this?
No.
Oh, you haven't seen it. So when I sent you the email all about how there's the white Mr. Big against, it's in the washed out Tony Scott looking cinematography. Oh, wow.
Well, it's directed by Tony Scott.
Oh, is that right? Oh, I forgot.
and Bruce Willis's buddy co-star is Damon Wayans, who isn't the first person you think of when you think of action movie stars. But
and then
written by Shane Black, the writer of Lethal Weapon.
And I don't know if he got paid an exorbitant amount of money for this one, but he very well may have.
Other cold-blooded, misogynistic, and sadistic action.
Yeah, we'll have to see about that. And Shane Black, of course, being the guy who's taken his own sort of misogyny and commented on it in sort of a weird way in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but whatever. Yeah, because he made some... And Shane Black, to genre fans, of course, was in Predator as the Hawkins, the nerd,
nerd,
who told sexist jokes the whole time. So, yeah.
Yep,
hold on.
That's...
How much money? I just want to see if I can find out how much money he made, because, yeah, they don't give a price tag. $1.75 million. He was the highest paid screenwriter at the time, before Joe Esterhaus and Showgirls, presumably.
Why are the highest paid screenwriters of all time the worst? we'll try to figure that out next week, I guess. So check out the site alansmithypodcast.info for information about an Alan Smithy podcast. And yeah, we will see you next week, I guess. This has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
This has been an Alan Smithy podcast. Bye.